different forms of an exchange, so they can either do a semester abroad with a group of people, or they can go by themselves and study in another place.
And why did you choose to go abroad through SIP?
I thought it would be a good way to really get immersed in a culture, as opposed to taking a two-week long trip or something. It was an opportunity to really live somewhere and also work towards finishing my degree. So,
and where did you go and what did you study?
I went on exchange to the University of the South Pacific, which is located in Fiji. And while I was there, I was studying psychology courses.
And can you tell us a little bit of sort of what you're studying here at Guelph and how and if that related to what you're studying there?
Yeah, here I also study psychology here. I minor in drama here, which I didn't take any drama classes while I was there, although they were offered. And basically the programs are pretty similar. In Fiji, they have psychology set up into three different categories. You can do counseling, clinical, or applied, and educational. So in that respect, they have it more specified, but it was basically the same.
And so for those who don't know, can you tell us a bit about what Fiji is like, where it is, what's the current political situation?
Fiji is a beautiful, beautiful place. The first thing that struck me about it was how lush and green and leafy it is. Like, it's just drenched in color. It's beautiful. And the people there are incredibly friendly. There wasn't a person I met that didn't offer to make me dinner or have me come to their village with them and meet their family and friends. So that was really, really nice. There was a real welcoming feeling there. Politically, they've been independent for about 30 years now, a little over that, I think, from they used to be a British colony. And although they've had a few threats for coups in the last few years, it's still pretty stable. So they're doing all right.
And can you paint a picture for us of what the University of the South Pacific is like? I think a lot of people, when they think of Fiji and the University of the South Pacific, would probably get a really tropical view in their mind of maybe buildings on the beach and palm trees. And can you just let us know a bit about what it's like and how many students and the type of programs that they have?
The school is a little tropical. One of the things I remember saying right away on the first day was that it was like going to school in the jungle, which got me made fun of, actually. But anyway, it really is. There are vines everywhere and like palm trees, and the first day of school, I noticed that people were walking around with umbrellas, and I couldn't understand. It was so hot and sunny, and like I was like, you people are out of your mind, why are you carrying umbrellas? But and they have these weird roofs like all over campus, these strange like tunnel type passageways that I couldn't put it together. And then the second day of school, it was beautiful, bright, sunny, and then all of a sudden it was like a downpour came out of nowhere, and everyone went under these little pathways, and all the umbrellas opened up, and it all of a sudden made sense. Like, oh, the weather is a little unpredictable, and that's why the campus is set up this way. But it's like any university campus. You know, there's the administration building, there's the library, except that it's warmer, and all of the classrooms are open. Like, they're literally like huge chunks where the windows would be, and a lot of the times the doors stay open just so that the wind can continue to circulate throughout the class. So,
and what about the classes academically? Did you find them harder or easier? Were the exams the same? What did you find about that?
They were much easier compared to university here. One of the things that contributes to that, I think, is that for most people, English, well, for all people, English is their second language. So some people actually take a two-week-long crash course in English right before they go to the right before they start university. So they've been literally speaking their village dialect up until they're 18 or so, and take this course and then try and perform academically. So for me, going in with being fluent in English was an extreme advantage, and it made everything else so much easier. So that was one thing that contributed to the classes being a lot easier. Other than that, it's just everything is at a much slower pace and everything is a lot more relaxed, so there's not that stress. Like here, it doesn't matter. You probably will always have at least one or two things going on every week in something in a class, whereas there might be like one quiz and one final, maybe one project. It's very, very relaxed and slow. The pace is slower. So
That sounds like a big cultural difference. Were there any other differences that really stood out to you in terms of cultural differences?
That just basically the fact that it's a collectivist society. So people live with their families, their extended families. I mean, even when people are married, they just move in back, they just stay with their parents and their wife will move in with them. And that was something that struck me quite a bit, because a lot of my friends that were locals were talking to me about fights they were having with their parents about, you know, I couldn't really identify with that because I haven't lived at home for 4 years. So for me, I was like, well, I'm not in high school anymore. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I can't understand that feeling, but yeah.
And what about the other international students? Were there a lot of students there? Where were they from? How were they received by the local students?
There weren't very many other international students. I think the program's relatively new for the University of the South Pacific. There were two other Canadians and I think four other American students. And other than that, there were one or two people from Australia and a couple of people from Papua New Guinea. But it wasn't extremely, there weren't a lot of people anyway.
And did they, how were they integrated, or what was the relationship then between the few international students that there were?
They offered us a lot of get-to-know-the-culture experiences. So we had dinners with other international students, which were really fun. And we would get these different village, like different groups within Fiji would come and perform their traditional dances. And we would get to have, I ate traditional food all the time because I didn't live in residence, but for the people that lived in residence, it was really nice for them to get like a traditional sabu-sabu or something like that and get to drink like the kava. I don't know if anyone has heard of the kava, but it's like it's a local drink that leads to numbness and sometimes hallucinations. So that was fun part of international dinners.
And yeah. What, when you say typical foods, like what sorts of things are normal? Foods there?
Lots of fish, ika, that's called ika. Lots of fish and lots of things are prepared with coconut, dalo and cassava. Those are root crops. They're sort of like potatoes and they either boil them or fry them. And you can fry them and like you actually sort of dip it in salt and eat it. And it's really, really good, but it's really salty. Lots of fruit, like papa, which is papaya, mangoes, really, like, all the fruit is so juicy. Even oranges taste like something that comes out of, like, a Tropicana box. Like, they're so sweet and juicy. They're so good. So that would have been typical food, yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't be talking about this over lunch hour.
Yeah.
And do you still keep in touch with any of the other students that you met there?
Yeah, I have, I'm still really close to two of the guys I lived with, actually three, who were from, two of them were from East Timor and one was from Papua New Guinea. And we lived in a house and we became like family and we still talk quite a bit. And a couple of the other international students, we send out group emails every few months just to let everyone know updates and what's going on. So yeah, it's nice.
And what about any of the people who are actually from Fiji? Do you keep in touch?
Oh, yeah. The two women I lived with, my Auntie Ely and my Auntie Lo, I send them postcards. And I communicate to them through one of their husbands. He emails. A lot of people don't really use email, but he emails. So I get to send them messages through him. And I'm planning on sending them a Christmas package. So it'll be, yeah, it's good.
And what's your favorite memory from your time there?
Well, I don't. This is one of many favorites that I can. I was thinking of yesterday, was the last day I was actually in Fiji. I was staying in Nandi, which is where the airport is. So I lived in Suva, and then 4.5 hours around the coast is Nandi, where the airport is. And I was there, and James and Sumeri, the two of the guys I lived with, came to spend my last day with me, and we were on the beach, and we got to watch these guys go into the ocean with this huge net and fish. We got to watch them fish for crabs and stuff, and it was so gorgeous. It was like a sunset, and there was this beautiful sunset. There were these little kids like running around screaming and yelling in the water, and it was just such a beautiful way to end the trip, to witness that and be so happy to be a part of that culture and have really been able to participate in it. So that was the best one. And I was with two guys that I love, you know, two of my brothers, so it was really nice.
Nice. We're going to take a little bit of a music break right now. Again, we're talking to Jessica Fleming and Genevieve Gilbert as part of International Education Week about their experience studying overseas through the Center for International Programs. As always, if you have any questions, you can give us a call at 837-2378.
And actually, this is some music that we've got from Fiji. Could you tell us just a little bit about the music?
Yeah, this is a group called De La Isea. And we're going to hear a song from them called Samove, which is an incredibly popular song there. So hope everyone likes it.
Welcome back to Going Global. Again, we're talking with Jessica Fleming and Genevieve Gilbert about their experience studying overseas as part of International Education Week this week. Genevieve, can you tell us a little bit about why did you want to go overseas and where you went?
I just thought it would be a really fantastic experience to be able to travel and study overseas. So I'd also taken a lot of Spanish courses and been interested in Latin America. So I was also part of my interest in going overseas. And I went with a group of 15 students from Guelph, and we also met up with 15 students from the University of Saskatchewan. And we went to Guatemala, and we lived in Antigua, which is, it was the first capital and the colonial city in Guatemala, and it was about an hour and a half from Guatemala City. So Antigua is very beautiful. Because it was the first colonial city, much of the colonial architecture still remains there. And so all the streets are cobblestone streets, and all the buildings, they're mostly one-story buildings, very, very colorful buildings. And it's right between, the city itself is right between three large volcanoes. And it's actually right on the fault lines. So there have been numerous earthquakes over the years. And so as you walk throughout this city, there are many ruins of all the different cathedrals and churches and everything. And because it was recently declared a UNESCO heritage site, there are very strict laws. And so none of the buildings, none of these ruins can be torn down. And many of the buildings that remain, there are very strict regulations about building rules and also advertising rules and stuff. So there are no billboards, no overt advertisements. So it has a very unique charm to it that you don't see throughout the rest of the country.
Very interesting. So why did you decide to go to Guatemala?
Well, as I said before, I'd been studying Spanish for a bit, and I was just very interested in Latin America. And I just thought it would be a really good experience. And I was more interested in going to Guatemala than the other countries that were offered through CIP.
Did you know much about the country before you went there?
Not when I initially decided and signed up for the program, but as part of the preparatory training, we had to take a course, a humanities course, and so we learned a lot about the politics and the history of Guatemala before we actually went down there.
And what are some of the main issues that affect people there as far as maybe poverty or crime or sort of any of the main social issues?
One of the most important social issues that we were very much aware of when we were down there is the signing of CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And that is an agreement which includes the U.S., El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and Costa Rica. And so many of the farmers in the area were very, very upset, and there were lots of protests going on in Guatemala City. Because they're going to now be forced to compete with huge corporations and corporate agribusiness, and there's going to be lowered environmental standards, increased worker exploitation, less democracy, and overall greater poverty in Guatemala and the rest of Latin America. So that was definitely a major issue that all the students were aware of, and I remember reading in the newspapers about how different people in protests were killed or how many people were also injured. But a lot of the protests were going in Guatemala City, which was not where we were staying. So we weren't explicitly exposed to this, but we were definitely aware of it in the media and everything. And another major issue is the collapse of coffee prices in Guatemala and around the world, because in 1989, the industrialized countries decided to end the system of quotas for coffee. And so this was the International Coffee Organization, and they had originally kept production and consumption at a certain level to sustain adequate prices for farmers. But when they decided to end this system, and with the entry of Brazil and Vietnam to coffee production, immediately after, coffee prices fell dramatically. And so this has a huge impact on Guatemala because it exports a lot of coffee. And one of my friends actually had the opportunity, he was from the University of Saskatchewan, and he had an opportunity to go and see a coffee plantation, and he said that it was one of the most moving and really saddening experiences he had had, because he saw very young children and people just working so hard on these coffee plantations and making next to nothing. Another thing that we really noticed when we were down there was just the pervasiveness of guns and arms and stuff, because Guatemala suffered one of the worst civil wars, longest and bloodiest civil wars in all of Latin America. And they just recently signed the peace accords in 1996, and these peace accords still haven't been fully implemented. But the legacy of the civil war is still very prevalent, and so everywhere people will have guns. And my family was, the family that I stayed with, my host family, was very concerned about the gangs, the armed gangs and everything in the area. And so they made sure that we had a strict curfew and that we were home by 11 p.m. every night. That was our family. Other students lived in houses where they didn't have curfews and they weren't so concerned, but it's still a major issue right now.
Were these some of the topics that you learned about in your classes? Can you tell us about your classes, who taught them, and the kinds of topics that you covered?
Yeah, definitely. Before we went down, we learned a lot about the history of Guatemala, and particularly the Civil War, which was primarily funded, armed and trained. It was paramilitaries who were armed and trained by the U.S. and the CIA, and the overthrow of the democratically elected leader in 1954 in Guatemala. So we learned a lot about the history there, and then when we went down there, before we went down, we were required to take at minimum 2 Spanish courses. And then when we were there, we took 1 Spanish course, as well as other courses. One course I took was politics of Latin America, and particularly Guatemala. So we learned further about the peace process and the peace accords and how it's very difficult to implement these accords. And so they're signed, but it's really putting what's on paper into action.
So were these normal classes that were given through the university, or did you have special, like people who were involved in these topics come in and give you seminars about them, or how did that work?
Well, what it was a program that was set up through our university, the University of Saskatchewan, and a language school that was down there. So our Spanish courses were through the language school. And then after, that was for the first month, and then for the 3 following months, we had classes with both a professor from Guelph, a geography professor, Harold Bowder, and a professor from the University of Saskatchewan, as well as local Guatemalan professors. And we had classes in the language school, but it wasn't actually through a university in Guatemala.
Okay, and so what did you find in terms of it relating to the studies that you've already done here, relating to your major and your credits being transferable?
The credits were automatically transferred, so there was no problem about that. And the professor from Guelph who went down with us is actually a geography professor, and I'm majoring in geography. So that was beneficial to me because I was able to do 2 field projects, which were geography courses and directly related to my program. And then, obviously, my 3rd course was Spanish. And then another requirement for the Guelph students was to participate in, it was a course that was designed around NGOs in the area, researching various NGOs in Guatemala, and looking into them and then giving a donation at the end. So those were the 4 main courses, and then I took the politics course as well.
So you mentioned you did some geography-related projects and maybe some work with NGOs. Can you give an example of what you were doing?
Which one? NGOs?
Which one would you like to talk about?
Okay. Well, through the program, we were really encouraged to get involved with the community, really encouraged to do volunteer work. So I think almost all the students who went on the semester abroad did some sort of volunteer work, be it working with an NGO in the area or volunteering at a local school or something like that. So my roommate Farah and I, actually, we both volunteered at a local school nearby. And we were teaching young kids who often came from very pretty bad backgrounds. A lot of them were beaten and abused, and they were just craving attention. So the second you walked into the room, they'd be jumping on you and like holding you and hugging you. So they were very young kids, and we would teach them reading and writing in Spanish a couple times a week. And then we'd also, through that school, we would also go into the local market. Every day there was a market in Antigua where we lived. And there were a lot of older kids who had never had the opportunity to go to school, and they didn't know how to read or write. And so we'd go into the market and sit with them and teach them once in a while as well.
And it sounds like then you were pretty busy, but what did you do with your time when you weren't in classes? Did you take any trips, or what else did you do?
Yeah, for sure. There were a lot of major trips that we did through the actual program and with our professors, so the whole group went on them. One of those trips included a trip to Tikal, which is one of the ancient Mayan ruins in the Yucatan Peninsula. So as a group, we all flew up there and stayed in, it was a kind of cottage-like housing area nearby in the actual park itself. And then we took other trips to Livingston and other areas of Guatemala. And then also, as students, we took a lot of trips just on our own with a group of students. So, for example, I went to Monte Rico, which is a black sands beach, with a couple of my friends. And then, so besides for traveling, We stayed with a host family, and my roommate and I were very involved with our host family. And they treated us like we were their daughters. So every meal we'd have with our host family, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and we were invited to a lot of family events. So we got to go to a wedding and lots of birthday parties. And then every Sunday, the grandsons would come over, so we'd watch television with them and stuff. And then besides for that, just a lot of volunteering and NGO work. Through the course, our NGO course, one of the requirements, as I said before, was to research different NGOs. So what I did with the partner I was working with was we researched an NGO called Camino Seguro in Guatemala City. And in Guatemala City, there is a huge Guatemala City dump. And a lot of the very poor people work in the dump, and they collect plastics and cardboards and stuff, which they bring out of the dump and try to sell. And very often their children would be working with them. And so this organization called Camino Seguro was an attempt to get the children out of the city dump and into schools. So what my partner and I did was we arranged a tour for the whole group to go and see the dump itself. We got a chance to look over. The dump is in the bottom of a huge valley. So what we did was we went to a cemetery on top and looked over and saw what these people did for a living. And it was very moving. A lot of us had a hard time with that. And then we saw the schools where the children lived, and there was also another residential school for kids who lived in the worst situations and who were physically and sexually abused, and so they put them in a residential school. So, yeah.
And how did they work towards getting these kids out of the dumps and into the schools? Because I think a lot of it, you know, if that's the only money mm-hmm. that they're providing to their family, you know, like how did they work mm-hmm. with the family and the kids to get them
that,
out of there?
Yeah, that was another big issue. There actually, when we were there, there was a huge fire that occurred. And so when we first arrived, the kids would be working alongside their mothers in the dump. But there was a huge fire, and we actually saw it when we were flying back from Tikal. And so that was a major catastrophe, and it released a lot of toxins, and it was just really not a good situation. And so they made a law after that saying you can't bring kids in here. But that was a huge problem, because the mothers then they had to stay home and look after their kids, and then they couldn't work. So this organization, it was working, and it provided incentives for children to be in school as well. They would give baskets of food to the family if the kids made a certain number of classes, and various other incentives. And they had a lot of social workers working with the families. So really, it wasn't just the kids. It was encouraging the whole families to promote education.
And what about any cultural activities?
Well, the biggest cultural activity was Semana Santa, which is, it was Holy Week leading up to Easter. And so this is a huge, huge cultural event in Antigua. And what it consists of is a lot of processions of people coming from various other villages nearby and also within Guatemala itself. So people carry enormous wooden floats with different statues of Jesus or Mary on top. And then the people in the city itself of Antigua will create, they call them alfombras, which are carpets, and they're made out of either colored sawdust, vegetables, flowers, and pine needles. And so they'll cover the streets literally for a week, and the city gets absolutely packed, and you can't even enter the city. Like, no cars can enter by the time you hit Good Friday. And we made a carpet with our family in front of our host family in front of our house. So the carpets are for the processions, and the processions will come and walk over them, so they're ruined as soon as the procession walks over them. And Good Friday, my roommate Farah and I were up all night walking around with the grandsons, Jose Manuel and Jose Alejandro. We walked around Antigua all night long from 6 p.m. to probably about 5 a.m., watching everybody in the community make these very, very elaborate carpets out of colored sawdust for the procession the next morning.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, we're going to go to a song that you brought. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
This song is by Don Omar. He's very, very popular in Guatemala. He's one of the most well-known reggaeton artists in Latin America. He was born in Puerto Rico, and he's now getting much more successful in the U.S., and so he has a lot of English-speaking fans as well.
Okay, great. Let's try it out.
Me vuelve
donde quiera que la coma de vuelve. Tu cuerpo a mí me mata, nena. Tu cuerpo a mí me vuelve loco. Tu cuerpo a mí me mata, nena. Tu cuerpo a mí me vuelve loco. Tu cuerpo a mí me mata, nena. Tu cuerpo a mí me vuelve loco. Tu cuerpo a mí me mata, nena. Tu cuerpo a mí me vuelve loco.
The CSA Human Rights Office presents Canada and Haiti, Our Iraq, featuring current reports from Haiti and a screening of Haiti, The Untold Story, on Saturday, November 19th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Norfolk Street United Church. Learn about the disturbing ways in which Canadian intervention in Haiti is contributing to serious human rights abuses and the repression of democracy in Haiti. Find out how to get involved locally to build solidarity with the Haitian people. This event is taking place as part of the Pan-Canadian Call for Solidarity with Haiti. For more information, check out the website of the Canada-Haiti Action Network at www.canadahaitiaction.ca. Canada and Haiti, Our Iraq, Saturday, November 19th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Norfolk Street United Church.
Hi, and welcome back to Going Global with your hosts, Nikki and April. As part of International Education Week this week, we're talking to Jessica and Genevieve about their experience studying overseas through the Center for International Programs. As always, if you have any questions, you can call us at 837-2378. Looking back, this is a question for either one of you. Looking back, what do you wish you had known before you had gone overseas?
I wish that I had known to trust myself right away a little bit more, to go with your gut always, just to avoid potentially dangerous or, you know, a little bit scary situations. But I think that's something that people who study or who travel by themselves learn relatively quickly. Within like a week, I was like, okay, I got to count on myself, and that's how it is. And not that other people aren't. Most people, 99% of people, are kind and helpful and have no malicious intentions, but every once in a while you have to be careful, because especially in a place like Fiji, the foreigners really do stand out and it can propose problems. So,
and what surprised you most about the culture?
I think Jessica spoke about this earlier. It was just how generous and caring and friendly the culture was there. And if I ever had a question, someone would literally hold my hand and help me find like what I was looking for, where I was going. And also, as she spoke about, again, like how a lot of the family, they have very big extended families, and often the whole, many family members will live together, and on Sundays, many of the extended family will come over. So the culture was different in ways. Like, there was one moment when one of the grandsons, he's 19 years old, and he was sitting on his grandmother's lap, and it was just kind of a moving image that you don't often see here. So, yeah.
And were there any particular elements of the culture that you found hard to adjust to?
I found that it was a little difficult at first for me to get used to the extreme religiosity of the culture. I'm a little bit more accustomed to a liberal view of religion, whereas there it was very cut in stone, and in both in terms of Hinduism and Catholicism and so on, and Christianity of various sorts. So I had to get used to not necessarily being respectful of that, but just being ready that I was involved in it. Like, there was no choice, and I was going to church, and it was really nice. The music was beautiful, and it was fine, and it didn't particularly change my views about my own belief system, but it was nice to experience and really fully experience other views on life and the almighty powers of above and so forth. It was cool.
And what were your living conditions like?
Well, we were placed, all the students were placed with host families. So some of us had roommates, some of us didn't. Most of us did have roommates. So I lived with one of my friends from Guelph named Farah, and other people lived with many more roommates. So we lived in houses and with host families. We lived with two grandparents, their daughter and their grandson. So every meal we would eat together and participate in family events and stuff. So we were very much welcomed into the family and kind of treated as family members. But the living arrangements were all kind of different. And we were very lucky to be placed with... I thought I was so lucky to be placed with the family that I was placed with, because they were just amazing, and we really got close with the family members. Other people weren't so happy with the situations they were in, and so some students decided to leave, either switch houses or move into apartments, but we both I stayed with my family, and my roommate actually switched into my house just after 2 weeks, and it worked out really well after that.
I also actually lived with a family. I was supposed to live in residence, but when I arrived at the university, they didn't have a room set aside for me. So I actually wound up living with a girl from my class for 5 days. I just received her phone number and phoned her crying because I had nowhere to live, literally. And her family was kind enough to let me stay with them for 5 days, and they really helped me find a place to stay, and then I stayed with another family for a week and a half before I moved into my actual house. But I was staying in a really beautiful house at the top of a hill, so I could look down and see palm trees and the ocean, and it was gorgeous. And I lived with about seven boys who became my brothers. It was like living with a small team of practical jokes, but anyway, They're international students, as well as some Fijian students, and I lived with two Fijian women and one of their daughters. And again, it was, like Genevieve was saying, we just became so close. We ate all our meals together, and there was a lot of love in that house. It was really nice.
And do either of you have any advice on how to adapt to living with a family or to living with other people in cross-cultural settings?
I would say just... I mean, obviously, if a situation isn't working out and you know that if you change and you'd be more happier, definitely do that. But at the same time, you really have to be accommodating and really have to put an effort into both, in my situation, learning the language and getting to know the family members and trying to get involved with the people you're living with in your living situation, because that's what made it so much better and that's why we had such a good time. So definitely that's important in having a good housing arrangement.
I also want to add that I think it's important to realize that most, not necessarily arguments, but little problems that can occur really have to be looked at from a cultural perspective. So if something happens that, I mean, I remember being really confused as to why I couldn't do my laundry with Like, I couldn't put my laundry in with my brother's laundry. And I didn't understand. I thought it was stupid. But it's important in that culture and those women's beliefs that that's just not something that men and women do together. Like, it's just not okay to have to be pulling out laundry and seeing somebody else's underwear that's a different gender than you. So those sort of miscommunications really need to be looked at from a cultural perspective so that there aren't hurt feelings, because that's really what it comes down to, is it's just a matter of culture and communication.
Mm-hmm. And what type of orientation did you guys receive before you left?
Well, as I said before, we had to take a course called, it was a humanities course, learning about the history and the politics of Latin America. And then in that course, we also had what we called maybe housekeeping issues. So we were able to book our flights together, arrange vaccinations, all those sorts of things, and just discuss maybe safety issues for women and stuff like that going down to Latin America. As well, we received a pre-orientation training session through the CIP. And we also got to speak to other students who had previously been on the semester to Guatemala to hear what they said about it and what their experiences were like.
And what did you do to personally prepare before you left?
Well, it was just being aware of maybe safety issues and again, listening to the experiences of girls, students who had previously been on the semester was definitely very helpful. And I think also being personally prepared, it was, my situation was a little bit different from Jessica's in that we went down with a group of 15 students, not just ourselves. So I think personally, like, I felt like there was a support group there for me, and I think that helped a lot for me because I hadn't traveled very much on my own. And so I think I would have been much more hesitant, much more scared to do it all by myself.
I was actually traveling. It was one of my first traveling experiences, so I was taking into account when I was preparing myself that I'd never done this before. And aside from doing all the medical preparations, financial preparations, and so forth, I found it really important just to write to myself, what do I want to accomplish from this? How am I going to handle situations that I can't prepare for? And just remind myself that I'm capable and that I could do it. And sort of it's like preparing yourself mentally for something you can't prepare for, basically. So,
do you wish that you'd had more travel experience before you went, or do you think the fact that this was your first experience overseas, it was more beneficial to not have a lot of travel experience?
I think that maybe it would have just given me something to compare it to, but now instead of, I mean, I had gone on trips with my family and things like that, but they're usually to hotels. I mean, it's not going to Cuba if you're staying in a resort, really. It's similar, but you see the beaches and so forth, but you don't really see the culture. I think it was really nice not to have any other experience because it was like going on a wonderful adventure, and I was really like throwing myself right into it, and I feel proud of myself for doing that. I think that was courageous and something to be happy that I had done that way.
And like Jessica, I had also traveled a lot with my family. So I'd been to Cuba before and I'd been to France before. But going down there, I did travel on my own after I went down there. So I traveled to Samu Champey, which is a little bit north of Antigua where we were living, and also into Mexico and through Belize and back down to Guatemala. But that was after I'd already arrived there. And I feel like through that experience, I gained a lot of self-confidence and knowing that I can do this on my own. And yeah.
Okay, great. We're going to go to one more song from Fiji.
This is a song by Doki Doki. Doki Doki are three brothers. They are incredibly popular in Fiji, and the song is called Raile Suva.
Oh,
back to Going Global with your hosts, Nikki and April. As always, if you have any questions, you can call us at 837-2378. We're talking with Genevieve and Jessica about their experience studying overseas through the Center for International Programs, as this is International Education Week this week. So again, questions for either one of you. Were there any similarities to studying overseas in comparison to Guelph? As in, you know, do they have a lot of sports teams and clubs and in comparison to classes and lectures?
I didn't really notice much as far as... There weren't too many things that were different as far as there were clubs, there were sports teams. But the type of teams, I mean, rugby is huge in Fiji, so most people spend their intramural time doing rugby. It wouldn't be, I mean, and any time I heard people talking about hockey, they were talking about field hockey, and I'd have to make that adjustment in my mind that, oh yeah, they don't have ice here, and nobody knows how to skate. So it was the same sort of setup, it's just that within the setup, there were differences.
Because we weren't with a university, we were just with a language school, it was very different in that there weren't really sports or clubs or anything that was through our semester abroad down there, but many students decided to join gyms or something just to keep fit and just get involved with volunteering and NGO work outside of the classroom in the community.
And what was the most challenging part of the experience?
The most challenging part of the experience, that could have been probably just starting to travel. I found it difficult because in Fiji, it's really common for people to offer you a lot of opportunities, but then it's just that if something comes up, they will take that over their planned event. So people don't really make plans. You can't take it personally. It's just the way it is there. So a lot of times I was waiting for, I was accepting these offers thinking, okay, this weekend I'm really going to get to go and see Levuka and I can't wait and all the rest. And then Friday comes and it's like, oh no, we're not doing that anymore. We can't go. So it was challenging for me to realize like I have to make the plans myself and find people who want to come with me as opposed to riding the coattails of other plans sort of thing. So.
One of the most challenging things for me was just within Guatemala there is a lot of racism because there's there's a huge indigenous population and then there's the Ladino population, which the Ladinos are often more wealthier and have higher status and more power. So the family we were living with was Ladino, but we had a maid who was indigenous. And it was kind of seeing how we had actually various maids. When I first arrived, the maid's name was Sarah. And it was kind of seeing how these maids were treated. They were paid barely next to nothing. And the first maid, Sarah, she and I got very, very close. She was definitely one of my best friends when I first got down there. And so we'd have long conversations and stuff. And it was very challenging seeing the situation she was coming from. She worked very long hours, extremely long hours. She'd be in our house at 6 a.m. working until 6 or 7 in the evening. And so an unfortunate situation happened, and she left the house. So that was very challenging for me.
And could each of you guys talk a little bit about what you think you personally most learned from the experience?
I feel like I gained a lot of self-confidence when I did push myself. Like, the first time I traveled completely by myself, I was terrified. I was like, oh my God, what am I getting myself into? But I realized you meet so many people along the way, and I had some of the most, like, the best experiences traveling by myself. So that definitely was something I learned a lot. It's greater self-confidence and also an appreciation for different cultures. I've gained a huge appreciation for the Latin American culture. And, those were the two main things that I gained from it.
Yeah, I agree with Genevieve that I really learned to appreciate the differences between Canada and other places. But I feel like I also gained a really big appreciation for Canada, and until you're taken away from it, you don't realize what a great place it is to actually live in, and that we don't worry every day about our safety, and we don't worry that, you know, anything can happen to our country at any moment. We really have that blessing here. And also I gained that confidence in traveling by myself and counting on myself that I, you know, it's not that scary you can do it, and it just takes doing it, basically. Yeah.
Wonderful. I'd like to thank you both for coming in. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd love to keep talking more about this. For those interested in more information on the Center for International Programs, you can go to www.uoguelph.ca/sip, that's /CIP. And we're going to end with some Canadian music by Joaquin Diaz, and it's Spanish-Canadian music.
This is actually from an album called Hola, and it's a song called Me la pusieron difícil. Have a good week.
Have your say at bbc.co.uk. Also, talking in Tunis, why some countries say internet censorship is good, and talking nonsense. As Roy Keane walks out of Manchester United, we celebrate the biggest mouths in world sport. You talking to us. World, have your say. But first, the news.
BBC News with Jill Anderson. The United Nations Nuclear Agency says that instructions on how to build a crucial part of a nuclear bomb were among papers handed over by Iran during investigations into Tehran's nuclear program being carried out by the agency. Iran is said to have denied asking for the instructions, which were apparently provided by the nuclear smuggling network run by the disgraced Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
The confidential IAEA report seen by the BBC said the agency had received documents from Iran on the casting and machining of enriched, natural and depleted uranium metal in hemispherical forms. A Western diplomat told the BBC that it was design information which could be used for a critical part of a nuclear weapon. A senior official close to the IAEA said Tehran had said the information was offered by the AQ Khan network, but that Iran had not ordered it.
Two suicide bombers have attacked mosques in eastern Iraq, killing at least 70 people and injuring many more. The bombers targeted two mosques in the town of Khanakin, near the Iranian border. Caroline Hawley reports from Iraq.
It was the start of Friday prayers when the bombers struck. Two of them walked right into the crowds of worshippers in two separate mosques and blew themselves up. Both buildings collapsed, trapping the dead and injured inside. The emergency services in the small town of Khanaqin were overwhelmed. They appealed for ambulances and medical supplies and sent wounded survivors to hospital in nearby towns. It's not the first time that Shiite mosques have been attacked, but it's